You are listening to Punk News Podcast number 241. Editor John Gentile back on the East Coast, back in my hometown. Watch out, all you sucker MCs. Johnny G coming out, clearing out, going to all the punk rock shows, hitting up all the punk rock action. Features editor John Gentile, recharged, re-energized, and ready to rock on the Punk News Podcast, the world's best podcast. Man, I love this podcast. We argue about the news. We argue about new jams. We read mail and yell at people. We get yelled at about Blink 182. This is the Punk News Podcast. So excited to be back again. So excited to keep on rocking. And here I am with Mr. Dynamite himself. He's hypercharged. He's turbocharged. He's like a Ford Ferrari, or that's not a car. He's like a F-150. He's like a Corvette Z08. He's revved up, ready to go. A Ferrari Testarossa. We are here with managing editor Adam White. Adam White, are you hella charged tonight?
I felt that I needed to do that. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm excited. Tonight. You know, we've had some doldrums over the past couple of weeks. Not a lot of news. We got a lot of news tonight. A lot of interesting stuff to talk about.
John, we almost met the other day.
We did. I'm genuinely sorry that we didn't. Honestly.
On the one hand, I am sorry that we didn't. But on the other hand, even though being stranded in the Philadelphia airport would have allowed me to meet you, the idea of being stranded in any airport is really, really low on the list of things I want to do with my life. So better circumstances will come about.
We could have made it like an 80s buddy flick where we cause hijinks in the airport. And like the miserly airport guard tries to catch us as we cause hijinks in the airport.
Yes, or we end up in some sort of jail.
Guantanamo Bay.
Yes.
And we are also here with the old school rocker, the Auto City rocker, the guy from Grand Rapids. Actually, believe it or not, Adam White, I was on the plane just like 6-7 days ago. I was sitting next to a girl who was flying to go back to school at Grand Rapids. And we are here with a guy from Grand Rapids. We are here with reviews writer Tom the Heavy Hitter Trauma.
Yes, it is a real place. It is, in fact, a real place, but we have colleges and everything.
The girl was, like, super religious. Like, she went to Calvin College.
Oh, yeah. We have lots of that.
And I was trying to break her out of her shell, but I think I just creeped her out. But I did my best.
We were founded by, you know, people who left their country because, you know, they didn't want so many freedoms as they had the other country, so they wanted some different types of freedoms. But anyway, yes, it's a real place, and it's all right.
Is Calvin College Calvinists? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a reformed. It's a reformed college. We have reformed and Christian reformed. It's like it's a very religious area. At least it was. It's not so much anymore. But it was a lot of Dutch people.
I think that's what Tesco V was raised.
Yes, he was. He was, as a matter of fact. He was a Calvinist. He was. Once in a while, he gets into his stories about his poor mother. His poor mother having him for a son.
So Tom Trauma, living out there in Grand Rapids, where also Step by Step takes place. Are you bringing down the religious hierarchy, the religious oligarchy, one mosh pit at a time? Is that what you're doing?
You know, there's room for all types of opinions in my world. So I'm really not trying to take it down. No.
Well put, Tom Trauma. Well put. I think we all can get behind that. But speaking. Oh, and that was a perfect segue, and I'm kind of bummed that I'm mentioning it. It's a perfect segue, but it is such a perfect segue. Speaking of all opinions, there was recently a rumble at the Street Dogs concert on St. Paddy's Day. Not a drunken rumble, but the following. At Tuesday night's show, which was St. Paddy's Day Street Dogs show in Anaheim, California, a bunch of neo-Nazis showed up. It's unclear how many. I think it was like three or four.
So they call that a gaggle.
That's a gaggle. Yeah. Neo-Nazis traveling gaggles. Well, the neo-Nazis showed up, and at first they started to mosh and they start to mosh a little bit harder and hit into people, and eventually they start to Sieg Heil. So what happened is actually one of the guys from the band, let me see, which guy from the band here? The guitar player, I think.
Lenny Lashley from Darkbuster.
That's it. He actually attacked the neo-Nazis along with the crowd and the security guards. It was actually like a big kind of like fist fight rumble, and eventually they threw the neo-Nazis out the door, including the street dogs helped force the neo-Nazis out the door themselves, the actual street dogs did. Here's what Mike McColgan of the street dogs said. I'll read the whole thing, honestly, because it's worthwhile. At this time, I would like to officially address what happened in Anaheim. Last night at our show in Anaheim at the House of Blues, while we were playing our song Final Transmission for a dear departed fan and friend of ours, United States Marine Corps Jordan Stanton, we noticed a group of neo-Nazis roughhousing and intimidating our fans and throwing up Sieg Heil salutes in the air. Their very presence, their hateful, bigoted and ignorant ideology is odious to us and completely unacceptable. We, with fans, friends, and the assistance of security, removed them from the crowd, and in the process of mitigating them out, some of us sustained superficial injuries. We can attribute those injuries only being superficial in nature to the House of Blues and their exceptional stay. Oh, we can attribute those injuries only being superficial nature because of the skill of the House of Blues security and staff. Our fans and our friends. After the neo-Nazis were removed, we continued with our show and finished the show without incident. In closing, we submit this: no neo-Nazis are allowed at our shows. We have always believed in equality and that all people are created equal. We will not suffer or tolerate bigotry in any manifestation, period. Respectfully submitted, Mike McColgan. So apparently this is a legal brief because it's respectfully submitted. So you know, here's the question. You know, all the punk rockers hate neo-Nazis, but a fundamental point of punk rock is free speech, or at least I think it is. Should neo-Nazis be allowed in shows? Should they be allowed to speak their, I guess, hatred ideology? Or should we boot them every time they walk in the venue? What's the point? What's the deal?
Go ahead, Adam. Sorry.
Oh, I mean, my half put together thought on this would have been can we respect their ability to maybe speak their stupid hateful views, but we also don't, does that extend to like letting them to our parties? Like if you're a private venue and you're having a show by a band that people have paid to come into, it does, and this is really more of a Canadian question, I guess, because our hate speech laws are different than yours and everything, but Does like the whole like First Amendment free speech thing like extend to that? Like it's a private event.
Here's the answer, and a lot of punk rockers, they love to point these out. They say this is a private place, so free speech laws don't apply because free speech only applies to governmental powers, which is true, but that's much messier than it seems. And here's why. For example, like a diner is a private establishment, but it's treated as a public establishment, even though it's privately owned. Like if you have a diner, you can't say no Italian people can come in. That's against the law, right? Free speech gets trickier. In a private venue, are you entitled to free speech? The answer is no. That's the answer. Generally speaking, no, unless it's a public event. This is not considered a public event. A public event would be like a campaign or like a political open house, something like that. But this is considered a private event, so Nazis are not – well, no one's granted free speech within the four walls of a private venue.
Hmm. See, what I've always heard about this, and I am by no means an expert in this, so please no one quote me about this, is that Canada has a little bit more stringent kind of like hate speech law that's worked into our that's kind of like worked into our constitution, and specifically a document that we've got up here called the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is where all this stuff is kind of spelled out. And it's a little bit more strict than I think the U.S. is, where it actually forbids some stuff that would get by in the U.S. under the basis of it being like a First Amendment thing. And the specific kind of like chunk of the code that matters up here is something that forbids hate propaganda which in Canada is defined, at least legally in this thing, as any writing, sign, or visible representation that advocates or promotes genocide or the communication of which by any person would constitute an offense under Section 319. And this is Section 319. So I would imagine that in Canada you could get into court and kind of argue that, you know, visibly being a Nazi might be one of those things that is promoting genocides. And if so, that could be outlawed. I don't really know. I mean, like, no one's arresting neo-Nazis for wandering down the street in Canada or anything like that. That's that I've never really seen any neo-Nazis wandering down the street because they don't have parades and stuff. But yeah, there's... I'm always curious to hear how this kind of thing plays. But so, John, you're the legal scholar here. You're the one who has to deal with this stuff in real life. Legal aside, what's the appropriate course of action when there's Nazis up in your party?
You know me, I always side on free speech. I always defend free speech, but these Nazis make it a little bit easier because they're beating people up. Well, free speech does not entitle you to beat people up, so you can boot them on that reason. But what if they walked in and would just say, we hate Jewish people, we hate gay people, we hate gypsy people? I say it's a public establishment. I mean, it's a private establishment. It's okay for the street dogs to kick them out. So I certainly back street dogs on kicking them out. However, one thing I got two more points, but one thing that concerns me, and actually not just in punk rock and everything, is any speech that we don't agree with, we immediately try to squash out and say, you can't say that, or you shouldn't be able to say that. I disagree. And here's why. I definitely think these neo-Nazi guys should be able to say all the stupid things they're going to say. Why are we scared of what neo-Nazis have to say? Adam, if you were walking down the street and a neo-Nazi said to you, Jewish people are evil, Adam, would you change your mind about Jewish people and suddenly think they're evil? No, right?
Well, let me answer.
Would you?
No.
Right. So, I mean, why? So... By silencing neo-Nazis or hate speech, and hate speech certainly is protected by the U.S. Constitution, by silencing them, we're only making it stronger and we're only causing it to fester more and making them think they have some sort of weight in what they're saying. Silencing people never works, and it only causes hateful ideas to fester. And also, frankly, you cannot draw the line between what is and what is not hate speech, you know?
All right, but on the note that you're making here...
Yeah.
Let's say the Nazis exist. We're not stopping them from existing. We're not stopping them from expressing the things that they want to express. However, in expressing these things, someone may punch them in the nose. Is that cool?
No, it's not cool, and here's why.
Because I'm kind of cool with that.
I'm not cool with that.
You can say what you want, but you might get a pop in the nose.
I'm not cool with that, and here's why.
Because it's assault, or?
Well, because it's assault, but actually there's a healthy body of First Amendment law on this. Basically, free speech – people like to say you're allowed to free speech, but you're also supposed to accept the consequences, which basically people mean if you say something that people don't like, they can hit you. That's bullshit. You are clearly protected by police powers in your free – and there's actually a lot of cases about this. And actually, originally, this was used to protect African-American protesters in the 50s and 60s. It used to be that in the 50s and 60s, when African-American people would protest white-only establishments, the white people would beat them up or whatever, the racist white people. And the cops would say, well, they can say whatever they want, you know – it's their free speech, but then the courts ruled resoundingly, no, the police have to protect you in exerting your free speech powers in a public place. So I am not cool with people hitting people just because they don't like what they're saying. If you don't like what they're saying, sit up next to them and say something better that shows how stupid they are. Otherwise, I mean, we're just a barbaric society, so I'm not okay with that. I think neo-Nazis are stupid. I think what they say makes no sense whatsoever. And I think they know that, honestly. And I kind of think they like being the bad guy. But I'm not okay with hitting someone just because you disagree with what they have to say. By contrast, let's say I'm a super conservative guy and I say, I think Republicans are stupid. I think Republicans are stupid. I mean, I think Democrats are stupid. I think Democrats are stupid. Can you hit me because of that? You know?
I think that the one, and of course I'm not advocating hitting people in the nose, But the one thing that usually makes this a little bit more of a cut and dry thing, at least as far as punk shows go, is the people that are Nazis that show up and express their Nazism publicly, they don't tend to be doing that in a non-violent, non-confrontational way. It's usually tied into some sort of we're gonna get really drunk and then fight people in the pit and be Nazis. So there's other factors in there that I think change it from maybe more of a speech issue into more of a someone's being a dick issue.
And I've got another point, but I'm interested in what Tom has to say, because he began this very Christ-like. He was like, let people believe what they want to believe. Tom, where do you stand on the Nazis coming?
Well, like you said, in this case, it was easy because they were being violent. But I don't even know if they were espousing their views, you know, were they wearing swastikas? I don't know what they were doing. Here's a little different angle, a little less serious angle, if you will. Do you remember last year there was a pretty big story about Ken Casey from the Dropkick Murphys running across the stage and actually kicking a guy's ass with his bass who was doing the Sig Heil? You guys remember that story?
Yes. Yeah, I do remember that, yeah.
I think that these bands are hiring fake neo-Nazis to come to their shows so they can beat them up and increase their street cred. What do you think about that?
Actually, my next point was exactly along those lines.
Because all these street punk bands, they all have a certain amount of neo-Nazi following. It's just the nature of the music.
Along those lines, is, you know, every once in a while they'll have like a documentary. It's like the KKK is still alive in the South, and they'll go down to Georgia, and like the KKK is like seven people.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Like, you they get tons and tons of coverage on in the news.
You can get seven wacky people to believe anything. You know what I mean? So here's my question: is should we even be giving this? I mean, I've been to a lot of punk shows. I've been to punk shows in New York, Philadelphia. I've been to punk shows in Central Pennsylvania. I've been to punk shows in Washington, D.C. I've been to punk shows in the Bay Area. Never seen a neo-Nazi ever at any punk show ever. Some people say that they're down like in Anaheim, which I think is really weird, but maybe they are. But I mean, how many neo-Nazis are there? Are there 10? Are there 100? Are there 1,000? Are there 100,000? I kind of think maybe there's like 20 of them, and we shouldn't even pay them any mind at all.
I used to see in Detroit, you used to see a half dozen of them show up at a show, and they were very violent. Really? You definitely didn't want to cross them. But that was 10 or 15 years ago now, probably 15 years ago.
Let's see. Here's the thing: like, if five neo-Nazis show up, why doesn't everyone just like if they're beating people up, why don't like 25 people just kick the shit out of them? How come that never happened?
I don't know that it was so much that they were beating people up; they were just so violent in the pit. You just kind of like, oh, forget this. You just kind of back up a little bit. But I remember going to see DRI. I'm sure you guys know who DRI is. And there was, man, that was violent skin. This is Detroit, you know. This is a black city, essentially. Walk away.
But actually, this kind of shows what cowards neo-Nazis really are. They'll show up and do that at a punk show. But would they show up and do that at a hip-hop show? No, they wouldn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I dare say no.
Well, I think that we want to play a little bit of music that is related to this incident here. This is John's favorite Nazi punk. No, notice it was John's favorite Nazi punk.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks. Yeah. I appreciate that.
So we're going to play a song from one of the parties in this confrontation here. So Street Dogs, one of their members as of late has been a guy named Lenny Lashley. Now, Lenny was the guy that hopped into the crowd to confront the neo-Nazi menace that was there. And Lenny, a lot of people who are into like Boston punk are going to know from being the brains behind Darkbuster. And he has since not playing with that act anymore. He's playing with Street Dogs. He's had a whole bunch of acts that he's been in. One of the things that he has is a solo act called Lenny Lashley's Gang of One. So this is a song from Lenny Lashley's Gang of One from last year. The song is appropriately called Hooligans. So here you go. This is from Lenny Lashley's Gang of One. It's called Hooligans.
Never worry about long lost love or romance. ever crosses our path, then fuck him.
Fuck him!
Back when we was hooligans. Drinking beers in the alley of the rat. Original B-Town firm. The Central Square and the lights go down on Broadway. We belong together. We stand proud and true. Remember when I said that I'd always be there for you? Back when we was hooligans. Back when we was hooligans.
And we're back from beating up neo-Nazis, telling them they suck, and just kicking them. Neo-Nazis, we don't want you here. We don't want to hear your hateful views. Get Nazi punks, F off. But let's talk about guys that are not Nazis. And in fact, some of the guys in this band are minorities. Teenage Bottle Rocket, they've released a new song. The song is called They Call Me Steve, and it's off their brand new album, Tales from Wyoming, due out March 31st on Rise Records. And this album is kind of a full circle album for the band, because this album is their first full-length album produced by Bill Stevenson of Black Flag, of the Descendants of All. What's interesting is, early on, when the guys were like 14 and 15 in the band, they actually had All play in one of their garages, and that's like the first time they saw Bill Stevenson up close, and they got to see All play like a show in one of the garages, and it was important to them. They've worked with Bill Stevenson here and there throughout their career, but this is their first full-length album with Bill Stevenson. Did you guys dig They Call Me El Steverino?
I gotta preface this with, like, alright, that didn't make any sense. I have to preface this with, like, I really like this band. I've always liked this band. I think these are great guys. I think I've liked, I want to say, a 95% of the things that they've put out. And I'm by no means, you know, seriously dislike this or anything like this, but Teenage Bottle Rocket just seems kind of sleepy to me. There's something that it feels like the foot's off the gas a little bit on songs like this, and I'm not sure what to make of it. And I know that there's someone, it might have been you, John, it might have been Tricky Ricky Frankel on one of the past episodes here, that said they heard the whole record, and it's actually a pretty great record. And I am entirely willing to believe that, but this song, it seems kind of pokey. It seems like there's a lack of urgency to it that I can't quite square with how I normally think of Teenage Bottle Rocket playing. So I'm waiting to hear the final product here and see how this thing plays out, but I'm not sure.
This is quite a few records for these guys. Now it's got to be six, five?
Five, I think.
The thing with me, Adam, is I like Teenage Bottle Rocket. I like this song. I really like every song I've heard by them. I like the couple of early Red Scare records that I have by them, but it's just not the Lillingtons. That's the issue with me. It's just not those three Lillington albums. I still listen to them regularly, and this just reminds me of that. But it's just not quite that. I think that's my issue with it.
I'm wrong. This is the sixth album.
That's a lot. This band has had a big output. So on the one hand, I definitely don't fault them for, I don't know, not personally appealing to me on everything that they've done if I've, you know, entirely enjoyed five albums worth of stuff, right? So that's a pretty good track record. I would still count this among a band that I like a lot. I'm not quite sure. And I've got to imagine that, and like normally when I hear a band that's putting out a song, new label, and it something seems a little bit off to me, my first thought is to go and to blame production or blame the producer or everything. But it's Bill Stevenson doing this, and so that doesn't quite square. So the only thing that I can really put together in my head is that this has got to be one of the slower tracks on an otherwise really cool record, and actually in the context of that record, it works. So that's why I want to hear this full record. I'm not giving up on it, but it's, I don't know, this, if my only exposure to this band was seeing a Minecraft video of this kind of stuff, I don't know if it would get me into it. But I guess that begs the question about, like, what do we think of this video? Are they jumping on a trend here, or is it clever? I don't play the game. For the people that are listening to this that aren't actually looking at what we've been looking at, the video for this Teenage Bottle Rocket record is, I don't know what the name is for it. They went into the video game Minecraft and they built out their whole storyline for the video and then played it out with the video game characters. There is a word for that art, for that thing. It's like machinima or mechanima or something like that. Anyways.
See, I thought this song, I actually kind of disagree about the song, Adam. I think it was a good song. Lyrically, it was, I don't know, it reminded me of the Lillingtons lyrically a little bit. You know, it had kind of a fantasy element rather than, you know, the songs about girls, Ramones thing. The video, I don't know. Will anybody remember what Minecraft is in 10 years?
I don't know. Children, if you see them on the street, are just wandering around draped in either, like, Frozen stuff or Minecraft
stuff. I know
stuff.
My kids play it, but I have no idea what it is. I've never played it. I'm a old fart, you know.
So this song works for you?
Yeah, I think it's pretty good. But like I said, I've liked everything I've heard, but it's not like I'm running out to grab their records either. You know, it's kind of one of those, if I see one, I see it, I'll pick it up kind of a thing. So I guess that doesn't bode well.
I'm thinking that I want to hear this whole thing, like, I don't know, like a half beat faster.
Were you a big Lillingtons fan or not necessarily?
I got into the Lillingtons after I was into Teenage Bottle Rockets, but it was during the first couple Teenage Bottle Rocket records was when I circled back and checked them out. So I don't have any like particular nostalgia for the Lillingtons. And to tell the truth, having heard Teenage Bottle Rocket first, the Lillingtons would always sound to me sort of like almost Teenage Bottle Rocket.
The thing with the Lillingtons, they had all the great science fiction lyrics and like classic monster movie lyrics and stuff like that, where Teenage Bottle Rocket is, I mean, both bands are Ramones core, don't get me wrong, but Teenage Bottle Rocket tends to be more the kind of, you know, mundane teenage lyric kind of stuff, if you will. So that's, anyway, I always like the Lillingtons. I mean, the voice is the same, the music is very similar, but for whatever reason, this just doesn't do as much for me as that did. So,
well, speaking of a band that's doing stuff for people, Hop Along is a band that's got a lot of people in the punk rock, especially orgcore, excited. They've got a new song out. It's called Powerful Man. It's going to be on their album Painted Shut out May 5, 2015 on Saddle Creek Records. Did you guys dig this new track by Hop Along? Are you guys fans of this kind of jam?
I don't think I'm the demographic for this. It was not for me.
Tom, who do you see enjoying this kind of music?
I don't know. My 13-year-old daughter? I don't know. It was not. I don't know. I don't know if she came up or if that band came up through punk circles or what, but I don't know what's particularly appealing to this, to the punk audience.
I actually liked it. I'm
it's very not, poppy. Don't you? I mean, it's poppy, no, essentially.
It's absolutely poppy, but there's a little bit of edge to the vocals. There's a little, you know, it's a little bit unpolished in a good way. I don't know the history of this band. I don't know where they're from which well their hype springs or anything like that, or what exactly started the punk news crowd's fascination with them or anything like that. But anytime I will go listen to something, and I'm still going to listen to something because, like, you know, the kids all seem to like this, I should go check it out. I do enjoy it. I've yet to get to the point where I have gone and actively sought out these guys, Hoplong stuff, but, you know, I could do it. I mean, they definitely kind of fall into into that same sort of crowd that's listening to stuff like I want to say like Kayatana and Waxahachie.
Exactly.
Joyce Manor and bands that kind of like that are striding a little bit of the line between like, they're doing kind of like they're doing indie rock, but they're not doing orchestral indie rock. Like they're doing indie rock that's a little bit more of just like garage, and I can get into that. I'm cool with that. I mean, sometimes they can get a little bit too cute and a little bit too twee for me, but I can dig this. I like this song. I'm cool.
Well, there you have it. But speaking of a band that's never been twee, that's never been cute, Black Sabbath. They've announced their last ever gig. It's going to be November 22nd in Japan at what is called the Ozzfest Festival in Japan.
Are you sure this isn't Ozfest and you just spelled it wrong?
Oh, I didn't spell it wrong. I took it from another website. But actually, maybe it is Ozfest.
It is Ozfest.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
I took it from John Robb's Louder Than War. And I was thinking John Robb could be accountable, but I guess not. So I guess it's November 22nd, 2015 at the Ozfest in Japan.
Maybe that's how you say Oz in Japanese.
Maybe it is. Also, the band's in the studio right now working with Rick Rubin on their follow-up to the album, 13, the most generic possible name for a Black Sabbath record ever, which was 13, but it was released in 2013. There have been I'm going to dispel this right now. Another website, which I'm not going to name, has said Bill Ward will be at the show. That's not true.
No.
Bill Ward has reportedly been asked if he wants to be at the show, but he almost likely will not be because, as we learned 2 years ago, Sharon Osbourne asked Bill Ward to play for free at the show, but after asking him to work for scale as opposed to getting a fair share of the band's income. So, once again, I am two thumbs down to Ozzy and Sharon. But let's pull back my hatred a little bit. Are you guys sad that Black Sabbath is going away? Is Japan a fitting place for the last Black Sabbath show? Is it time to hang it up? Are you excited for a new album?
Okay. Wow, that's a lot of questions, John. First of all, I would love to see how much money they're paying them to play that last show in Japan rather than London or Birmingham or New York or L.A. There has to be an astronomical amount of money involved, which is cool for guys like Geezer and Tony Iommi and potentially Bill Ward, who don't have, you know, Aussie money. They could potentially retire from this gig, but I don't think I'll be going to Japan to see it. I mean, it's nice that Black Sabbath is sort of tried to restore their legacy over the last few years, but you know, go on Wikipedia and look at how many people have been in this band over the years. It's been over 20 members. You know, Tony Iommi never really stopped playing Black Sabbath, and their legacy is so mixed beyond the first four or six albums, you know, which were some of the greatest music ever recorded. The rest of their legacy is, like I said, mixed at best. Soiled, yeah. Maybe at best.
But there's good music in the post Ozzy stuff. Dio's got
The two Dio albums were good. Actually, they made
there's
a third Dio album.
Three Dio albums, one with Ice-T on it, Tom.
I'm sure when they started in the late 60s playing their bluesy metal that they hoped someday they'd have a rapper turned police detective on one of their albums. But no, I'm a huge fan. I've seen a couple of different incarnations of this band. I saw them twice. At least twice with the full original four lineup, and then I saw a Dio lineup. And you know, I'm cool with Sabbath, but you know, there's no credibility to what they do anymore. It's strictly a for-profit venture. You know, I don't think there's a whole lot of artistry involved at this point. Ozzy can't even, you know, remember the words.
Now, I guess the one thing that could be that could be kind of interesting to this. Is that, I mean, now on the one hand, I don't give bands like this saying that they're doing a final anything, really any credibility to say that.
Given
that, like, you know, this is the kind of band where, like, if you went and you hit their Wikipedia page, there's probably like 6 or 8 different parts of this article that talk about the reunion. So there's been reunions upon reunions, and, you know, so that's, you know, I guess at some point they all have to die. And at that point,
yeah, I think physically, they'll die.
Physically, at some point, Ozzy is going to become like a pile of dust.
He'll just be on stage, and then all of a sudden, it just collapses into dust.
Yeah, just the wind starts to chip him away piece
like
by piece.
Like Obi-Wan Kenobi, there's just like an empty smock laying there in the stage. It just disappears. But I actually, just fresh news today, I just heard the news today. Ozzy's going under the knife, and he had to cancel some big gig down in Mexico in May, so maybe he's not as, you know, invulnerable as we think. He's no Lemmy, you know. He's not going to live forever.
Now, what I was going to say though is that, like, now I know that that 13 had Rick Rubin produce it, but Rubin's going to be producing this new record as well. Despite the fact that he's worked with them before, is there some hope that Rubin's sort of late career turn as the person that takes like aging acts and gives them something really interesting to do, is that some sort of magic that he could play on this last record then? I mean, you know, give him the Johnny Cash American Recordings treatment and let them, you know, show their age in a really cool way.
13 was a cool record. Honestly, it was a lot cooler than it should have been. Do you agree with that, John? Did you listen to that? I thought it was pretty good. I mean, I can't say I listen to it all the time, but I like the record.
I wrote a review of it, Tom, and I got to say, I was anti-Brad Wilk. I mean, it's a joke that the guy from Rage Against the Machine was replacing Bill Ward. That being said, that record was way better than I thought it was going to be. It's actually a pretty good record. Like, it's a very enjoyable record, despite the shitty title and the shitty cover. But, I mean, it had everything going against it. You know, it had Sharon Osbourne and Ozzy manipulating it. It had Brad Wilk on drums. It had a title and cover that was made by a focus group. But that just goes to show how great Tony Iommi and Geezer Butler are. Yeah. Getting back to Adam's question, can Rick Rubin save the band? Well, honestly, we're kind of post-Rick Rubin saving band in Rick Rubin's career. I mean, that was really back in, like, 2000, 2001. That was, you know, 15 years ago, 14 years ago. The reports now of Rick Rubin in the studio is that he just comes in, like, once a week, hangs out for, like, an hour, doesn't do anything. It's like he doesn't want to do it anymore. Maybe for a band like Black Sabbath, he'll be re-energized. But honestly, to make a Black Sabbath record, you need 4 things. To make a great Black Sabbath record, you need 4 things. You need Tony Iommi. You need Geezer Butler. You need Bill Ward, and you need Ozzy Osbourne, who is not a complete wreck.
I thought you were going to say Ryan James Dio.
I like Dio. Honestly, I think Dio's a lot nicer guy than Ozzy. But Ozzy, the fact is, I saw Black Sabbath in 2007 on perhaps one of the best festivals ever. Black Sabbath, Judas Priest with Halford, and Slayer, and maybe Motorhead, and it was awesome.
Where was that? That's nice.
Homedale, New Jersey, baby. That was one of the best days of my life. That was a great, great day. But that was like the last tour where Ozzy was still Ozzy, where he still sounded like Ozzy. He still had the pipes. If you've heard Ozzy lately, he sounds old. He sounds haggard. He just can't sing. It's time to hang it up. You know what I mean? I mean, and actually I'm going to point this out too, is people hate on Sharon Osbourne. They say, you know, Sharon Osbourne, she's so cutthroat, she's so cold. You know, she sued Tony Iommi for a trade, even though he's the guy that's kept being Black Sabbath when it was no longer commercially smart and Ozzy Osbourne was making all the money. He kept Black Sabbath alive and kept the Black Sabbath name in circulation. And then when Black Sabbath, you know, started making money again, she sued Tony Iommi for the name of a band he created. You know, she's the person that tried to cut out Bill Ward. It really isn't Shannon Osbourne. And I think that's kind of a symptom of, I don't want to say the women hatred, but I guess the bias against women in the music industry. Shannon Osbourne is Ozzy's agent. If Ozzy didn't want Brad Wilk kicked out of the band, I mean, Bill Ward kicked out of the band, he would say, Sharon, you're my agent. You may not kick Bill Ward out of the band because you're my agent. And if you try to do it, I'll fire you. If Ozzy didn't want to sue Tony Iommi, the guy that kept the Black Sabbath name alive, he could have said to Shannon, "Shannon, don't sue Tony Iommi, or I'll fire you as my agent, and you can't sue him." So really, Shannon is really just the – she's acting in her client's best interest. It's not Shannon Osbourne's job to preserve Black Sabbath. It's her job to preserve her client, which is Ozzy Osbourne. You can't say it's Ozzy Osbourne's job not to treat his friends like shit. But at every angle, all he's done is shit and piss on the people in the band that, frankly, he wouldn't exist without them. So, two thumbs down on Ozzy Osbourne these days. You know, I wish him well in health. I would not wish bad health on anybody. But, you know, he's behaved, and it angers me and saddens me that Tony Iommi has kind of forgiven him and continued as Black Sabbath with Ozzy, even after Ozzy sued him for trademark. I would never forgive somebody for that, but...
But he's making 10 times as much money with Ozzy as he was without him.
Well, true, but it's like, well, but A, I mean, he was, remember, Ozzy only sued Tony Iommi for the Black Sabbath trademark after about 6 years when Ozzy returned to Black Sabbath, you know?
Yeah, because he didn't want him doing it with Dio anymore. If you remember, right. They actually toured with Dio under the name Heaven and Hell.
Right, because Ozzy sued him, you know what I mean? Yeah. I would never forgive anybody. I would not forget, you know.
But, you know, you say you blame it on Ozzy because he's the client and his agent is acting on his behalf, but are we sure of his competency to make those type of decisions or to give his agent that authority? I don't know. I don't know if he knows Bill Ward's not playing drums for him, honestly, John.
True.
I don't know what he sees when he looks back
here. I think that's a little overstated. I mean, if he can get up there and sing, you know, if he
uses the teleprompter, though.
Well, true, and the okay, answer.
How about this?
Without a court examination, we'll never know, Tom.
The long-standing rumor, you know, his favorite thing to do at these outdoor festivals is to throw buckets of water on the crowd. Have you seen him do this? You ever seen him do this, John?
I haven't.
But the rumor was always that he had to throw the buckets of water in the crowd so he'd get himself wet because he always pissed himself on stage. Now, that might be a malicious rumor, and you might have to cut that out, but I always thought that was the funniest story. So,
well, anyway. I think what we should do as fans is sue Black Sabbath and demand a court examination of Ozzy to determine his competence to sign contracts.
File those papers immediately, please.
Fun fact, what do you guys think Ozfest is called in Mexico?
Ozfesto?
Oz Fiesta. Just like the best name ever. Oz Fiesta.
Oz Party.
Anyway, let's play. Unless Adam has something else to say, let's play a track. Okay, let's play. Adam, are you there?
Hey, yeah. Let's play a track. Yeah, do it.
So I got to tell a little bit of a story behind this. So we've got a fan way out there in England called Richard, and he was involved in the anarcho-punk scene and the punk rock scene in the early 80s, mid-80s. He was a big fan of Rudimentary Peni. As you remember, we played a band that he produced. We played one of their tracks. Well, he recently sent me over a copy of Napalm Death's first demo tape, which is insane. As I'm sure you guys probably know, Napalm Death is basically, you know, one of the most famous grindcore slash heavy metal acts. I mean, they're not strictly grindcore anymore, but, you know, they're a very, very famous heavy metal act. What a lot of people don't know is that Napalm Death is really either a first or early second wave anarcho-punk band. And what's even more interesting about Napalm Death is that the current Napalm Death isn't really the original Napalm Death. So I'll give you a little bit of history here. Napalm Death formed in like 1981 with a guy called Nick Napalm and Miles Ratledge. That was the first version of Napalm Death. They brought in a guy called, Justin Broderick, who's now in Godflesh, and they recorded a demo called the Hatred Surge demo. And this is the demo that Rich way out there in England sent to me, so thanks for that, Rich. And what's cool about this demo, it's Nick Napalm, Miles Ratledge, and Justin Broderick, who wrote all the music. It's them doing anarcho-punk. It's not really like grindcore at all. It's anarcho-punk, kind of Flux of Pink Indians, that kind of stuff. But then here's where it gets trippier. By the time the band began to record their first album, Scum, the lineup consisted of Nick Napalm, Justin Broderick, and Mick Harris, who's a drummer, right? Who's not Mitch Harris, who is now in the band. Mick Harris. But after recording the first side of the band, Nick Napalm and Justin Broderick quit the band. Justin Broderick went on to form Godflesh. Nick Napalm didn't do much afterwards. So on side two of the first Napalm Death record is Lee Dorion on vocals, who went on to form Cathedral, Jim Wheely, Beale Steer, and Mick Harris. So on Napalm Death's first record, which is called Scum, the only guy on both sides is the drummer, Mick Harris. But then on the next album, the lineup changes again, and it's Lee Dorian on vocals, Shane Embury, Bill Steer, and Mick Harris. And so this Shane Embury is kind of like Mr. Napalm Death, even though he didn't even join the band until their second album. But then the lineup changes again for, is it Mentally Murdered where it changes? No, Harmony Corruption, I think that's where it changes. Yeah. On Harmony Corruption, which is considered like their third album, a bunch of the guys quit again. Mick Harris is still in the band, so it's Mark Greenway, who is now the current singer, Shane Embury, Mitch Harris, Mick Harris, and Jesse Pintado. After that, Mitch Harris quits. So there's no original members in Napalm Death at all, and actually there hasn't been any original members in Napalm Death since like 1983, which is crazy. But I just find that fascinating. So I hope people find that as enjoyable as I do. Let's play a track off their Hatred Surge demo tape, first track. And this is going to blow some minds because it's not what you think Napalm Death usually sounds like. Let's kick it. And we're back. Did you guys enjoy that anarcho-punk history lesson?
Of course.
I'm just trying to hold all the disparate threads together for the family tree, John.
I mean, from a certain perspective, Napalm Death is the last never broken up anarcho-punk band from the original first wave, from a certain perspective. The lyrics still reference that. So anyway, we're running kind of long, so let's try to blast through this. Death Grips. As you might know, Death Grips is the controversial rap punk metal act, I guess rock act. It's two guys, and last year they said they were going to break up. Not only did they break up, they said they were going to put out an album, and Bjork was going to be on every track of the album. Well, it turned out that when they said Bjork was going to be on every track of the album, they actually just meant like heavily sampled and like mixed into the back, so you can't even hear her. Well. And also, other hijinks that Death Grips has done is they said they were going to play a show at South by Southwest, but they didn't show up, causing the fans to riot. They played a show solely on Skype. They did the Bjork thing, and they said they broke up. Well, it turns out they haven't broken up. They're going to release a new album. It's called The Powers That Be, and they're going on a fairly massive tour in June. So here's the question. It is, you know, the band constantly is doing these hijinks to, like, confuse people, and people are like, what are Death Grips going to do next? What are they going to do next? Some people think that's cool. Some people think it's a middle finger to the music industry. Some people think it's just kind of childish. The question is this interesting art? Is this valid, or is this just a bunch of stupid hijinks that people are worn out from? I mean, I think back to the Sex Pistols. The Sex Pistols did a lot of hijinks, too, like when they scammed EMI out of what do you call it, when you get money in the beginning of a contract?
Their advance.
So, I mean, is Death Grips daring interesting art, or is it just kind of like the same joke or the same trick over and over and over?
Go ahead, Adam.
I'm cool with any band that has decided that they're going to be difficult and I guess difficult as a bit of a marketing strategy these days, because it's we're a super saturated world, so you've got to, you know, you have to do something different to break out of the kind of normal album release cycle bullshit that we get in every single press release. So if this band is going to, you know, intentionally be strange and play with the truth and, you know, mislead people, but then change, you know, break people's expectations or whatever, right? That's a totally valid way to break through some of the noise. And I'm surprised that more bands aren't doing that. So I'm cool with it. I mean, it can be frustrating trying to cover them because you never know what the hell is the truth or what you're actually trying to talk about in a way that makes sense. But, you know, bands don't need to do what they do for our sake. So, yeah, I'm cool with it.
This would be one of my favorite bands, except for the music is not that good. Like, their beats are – all their songs are like 5 or 6 minutes long, but it's like the same like 4-second loop over and over and over when the other guy raps over it. The rapping is pretty good. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, very bombastic, you know, rap rock, I guess. It honestly doesn't sound that much different than Rage Against the Machine or even like Limp Bizkit. But the beats just are not – I mean, they might be interesting for 4 seconds, but it's 4 seconds over and over and over for like 6 minutes, and the raps are like arbitrary. Like the raps don't fit into the beats. You definitely feel like the beats were built after the raps. So it just – the music sounds kind of lazy. I mean, it's bombastic and it's a little grating on purpose, but it doesn't seem to go anywhere. I just wish this band made a little bit better music. And I don't mean more standard – or more pop music. I mean, music that just seemed to have a little bit more effort put into it. It just seems like the songs begin as they end as they begin after 6 minutes, and I just lose interest. And I think people agree with me. If you go to their SoundCloud, the first song has, say, 2 million listens. By the time you get to the last one, it's down to like 30,000 listens. So most listeners do not listen to the Death Grips album all the way through, and I think it's because they lose interest, but... whatever. I think what they're doing is interesting. I just wish the music was better. Speaking of something with great music, Penelope Spheres movies, The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 1, 2, and 3, are finally getting widespread release. They've been bootlegged for years and years and years, but there's never been a widespread official release of Decline of Western Civilization 1, 2, and 3. As, of course, you know, Decline of Western Civilization 1 is a documentary focusing on the early West Coast scene with Black Flag, Fear, The Circle Jerks, Alice Bag, Fear, X, and The Catholic Disciples. Part 2 is kind of heavy metal, a little bit more mainstream. It's got like Alice Cooper and Kiss in it. Part 3 is the least known of all of them, and it's kind of like some crust punk kids in the 90s. But here's the interesting thing is the bonus is going to be DVD commentary track, and it's done by Dave Grohl, and that riled a lot of people up. Do you guys think Dave Grohl is a good person to comment on this? Are you excited for this DVD release?
So I am super excited for the DVD release. I mean, this is a legendary documentary. I mean, I don't know if I've ever seen anything other than clips from it, to tell you the truth, but I've read about it for the entire – like, I feel like I've read about it nonstop from the entire time that I've been involved in doing whatever we do on Monk News. Like, It is just one of these like singular cultural documents of that punk scene that you know, everyone references and everyone's aware of, even if they haven't seen it. So actually letting people see it is probably a good idea. That said, the Dave Grohl thing, is it Grohl or Grohl?
Dave Grohl, I think.
Really? Oh.
You're saying that wrong. You think it's Dave Grohl?
Well, that's how I've always said it, but
I might be wrong, honestly.
Anyways. Let's find this out. No. Okay, so I understand why people would feel burnt out on having Dave be the guy to talk about this stuff. I mean, on the one hand, he's super likable and he's a music nerd and he could talk about all of this stuff in a way that is probably engaging enough. On the other hand, he has the problem that a lot of people that are, you know, super likable, non-offensive, you know, please everybody celebrities, in that he always gets tapped for this kind of thing. And because you always get tapped for this kind of thing, it seems a little bit more like you're doing it to boost your own personal profile than you are really for the product, because you don't actually have any connection with it. Like Dave Grohl's connection with the decline of Western civilization is tenuous at best, right?
Yeah.
So on the one hand, there's a lot of people that are just going to be like, ugh, Dave Grohl again. Like, can we get someone else to talk about this kind of thing? And I get that. But on the other hand, I'm sure he'll do a fine job. And I'm sure he'll be super appreciative of the material that's on there. And I'm sure that he'll, you know, appropriately nerd out about this material. And he probably knows it as good as anyone. So, you know, would there be someone different that could probably be doing this? Yeah. And does Dave Grohl get tapped for too much of this shit? Sure, but he'll be fine. I don't know.
Somebody asked him to do it. It's not like he forced himself upon it, right?
you know, it's
not like he did it Bill Cosby style. Like, I'm narrating this thing whether you like it or not, you know?
I mean, Dave's greatest fault in life is that he's become fairly inoffensive.
Yeah.
Well put, Adam. Well put.
I mean, he's as far as I know, and I don't want to get into any of the any of the post Nirvana dramas here or anything like that, but he seems like a nice guy. He's not trying to screw anyone. He just wants to play his rock and roll songs. I'm not super interested in his rock and roll songs by any means, but I like a few of them. And you know,
it's better than most of the crap on the radio.
Yeah, which is faint praise, I guess. But yeah. You know, it's but like I can't hate him for being, I don't know, not as successful. Edgy as, yeah. Yeah, for being successful and, you know, and not shocking me. Like that's, you know, so he's not in my like rock pantheon or anything like that, but you know, he's fine. Leave him alone. He hasn't fucked me over or anything. I don't wish him ill, I guess is a better thing. Like I have no beef with Dave Grohl. So, you know,
a lot of people have said, well, why didn't they get some of the original bands to be on this? And honestly, that would be better, except for I think a lot of the original bands weren't happy with how they were depicted in the interview scenes. I know, for example, Chuck Dukowski feels as though he was like depicted as kind of a dumbass, when that's really not Chuck Dukowski's attitude at all. I mean, Chuck Dukowski is quite intelligent. So maybe I think there might be bad feelings between a lot of the bands and Penelope Spheeris. Because, well, A, the documentary is a lot more famous than the bands, and also some of the bands were depicted in a light that it wasn't exactly genuine. I think, well, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but if you go search around the internet, you can find a lot of these bands talking about this documentary and a lot of them being not that happy about it.
Yeah, but think about what the effect would be if it was all the original bands or like, you know, members of the original bands that you had on to do commentary and to talk about it.
Well, that's interesting.
Right? You know? Because if you bring all those guys on, you in a way, you take away not that Dave Grohl's a spring chicken or anything, but you take away from the youth that the documentary is putting on display. Like you've captured a bunch of young people at a certain point in time, and that's one of the things that the doc really conveys, is like this was that scene, these were that people, this is what was going on. If you intercut that with like a bunch of 60-year-old, you know, old farts waxing nostalgic about that time, I don't know if that would take away from it. Like, I don't know if that would do the intended effect. Because if you bring back those original people, they're not necessarily going to look at the documentary and say, like, man, this music was exciting. I was so much into this as a kid. It was blah, 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 which is what I think Dave Grohl would do. They may come and be like, you know, oh, I remember that venue. Yeah, they knocked it down and put up a Stuckey's where that used to be, right? Like, I don't know if you're going to get too much of that kind of stuff.
See, I actually disagree with that. Adam, I think your angle is interesting, but from my perspective, I don't need to be told that this music is exciting. I know it's exciting. It's exciting for me. What I think would be an interesting perspective is to get Chuck DeCaskey, get Keith Morris up there, and they're like, yeah, this part happened. Like, it'd be interesting to see them critiquing the film and from their viewpoint saying what is inaccurate. Further, a lot of these guys, like Keith Morris, have got an insane amount of stories, and I would love to hear them ramble on about their stories while they're watching it. I think that'd be fantastic.
There is no reason they could not have done both things.
They could have, yeah. Anyway,
well, it's easier to have one guy talk about it all, I guess. You know, well, here's the thing. So the first movie is about the early 80s LA punk and hardcore scene. Darby's dead. Nobody wants to talk to Greg Ginn. You know, I mean, a few of them are not going to talk at all. But the second one was like Wasp. I mean, I remember very specifically seeing the second one, like the bass player for Wasp, like floating in the pool of his mansion, just so wasted out of his mind that he can barely talk. So I don't know. Dave Grohl could probably speak to that era as well. And I saw the first two. I don't know what the third one. The crust one. I didn't even know they made one. I never saw it, but this is cool, man. I'm looking forward to this.
Almost no one's seen the third one, but let's talk about
Almost no one's seen the first one. I think
that's true.
The second one was widely bootlegged in the late '80s, early '90s.
Very true. Speaking of another documentary, people are real excited about this. There's a new Joe Strummer documentary coming out. Not that we don't have enough already, but this one actually sounds kind of interesting. It's kind of unique. The documentary is directed by Nick Hall, and it's called I Need a Dodge, Joe Strummer on the Run, and it basically follows Strummer on from between the years 1985 to 1986, between the collapse of the Clash and him kind of hiding out in Spain for a year before he returns to the UK for the birth of his child. So it really is a rarely talked about period, Strummer immediately after the Clash. It's one that's really not talked about hardly at all. So this documentary runs the risk of kind of being like low budget and crappy and like, no, there's no primary sources. It's all secondary or tertiary sources talking about it. But it could turn out to be really well, be really interesting and inform us about a relatively unknown period in Strummer's life. I just hope it doesn't deify him too, you know?
This could be really cool. I'm actually really interested in the subject matter here, and you're exactly right that it's cool that we don't have, it's useful that it's not another.
The Clash from Grey.
Another Clash documentary, you know, like it's we have lots of those, and a lot of them are really well done. So this is entirely an era of Strummer and an era of I guess Clash lore that, you know, deserves some exploration. That's cool. I'm good with that. The only thing that I'm a little bit curious about is like, what is it actually going to be composed of? Because like, he vanished for a little while. Like, there's not a, I can't imagine there's a whole ton of footage. So is it going to be like a bunch of like pictures of the Spanish countryside and then people talking over it about what Joe was doing during the time? Like, I'm curious.
Still black and white photos of highways. It would be interesting, and do they have knowledge of what? It would be interesting to know what was going through his mind at that point, certainly. But do they know that, or are they speculating? You know, do they have some sort of inside knowledge that we didn't have before about this period? Hopefully.
Yeah, apparently, he hung out with some Spanish band while he was down there, and a lot of the documentary includes interviews with these guys from the Spanish band.
Okay.
I mean, there's got to be like a lot of stuff that you could like, you know, slice out of earlier interviews with Joe when he was alive and kind of like piece all those bits together for something like this. So, you know, there's a story to tell here, I guess. So I'm curious. I'd be really curious to see what they do with it. And I'm actually genuinely interested to see this more than I would be another Clash documentary, although I would totally watch another Clash documentary.
Do you guys think Joe's being deified?
Yeah, because he died a little too young. You know, he died young enough. I mean, he wasn't 27 or anything, but I think he was still kind of still, you know, in his prime when he died. That always...
Like, people always talk about Joe Strummer's this more... And I'm not dissing Joe Strummer. I love The Clash. I think The Clash are great. I think Joe Strummer's a phenomenal artist. But I do think he's a little bit overly beatified in that, like... Like, people often quote The Clash or even Joe Strummer tracks as, like, this wise, sage wisdom, this broad statement of morality. But let's be real here. I mean, he's down in Spain banging chicks while his wife or his partner is pregnant up in the UK. You know what I mean? So it's not like he's, like, Mr. Wholesome, you know, blue jeans or whatever.
No, and you're – I don't know about that, but you're right about you're right that he has been – You know, he has been put on that pedestal, and I'm troubled with that because I, on the one hand, The Clash, my favorite band, Joe is, you know, one of my favorite personalities out of punk rock. I'm an immense fan. I probably always will be. And, you know, it's been one of those things where, like, even if I was to just, like, completely forgo participating in music anymore, I guess, that I would still be a huge Clash fan. So I've got that. You know, caveat to this, but I'm genuinely not happy with how much we tend to beatify or expect the saintly attitudes of old punk musicians. That's fine for like the wider rock and roll world, but like this is punk rock, like we can do something a little bit different than that, and. We don't need to put everyone on that kind of pedestal because the problem with it, it's less so a problem with Joe not deserving the accolades that he's got, but it makes people appreciate the more difficult artists less because they don't live up to this like saintly attitude. I have the same problem with Ian MacKaye, although he's not dead, right? A lot of people look back and will put him on this pedestal as being like, this is how you should act. And then they look at like, you know, they look at a band like the Sex Pistols and John Lydon, who to me is absolutely as interesting a character as Joe Strummer.
Back.
And right. But people are like, oh, I hate him. He's a dick. They were a boy band, whatever. Right. Well, it's like, well, hold on. You're taking like an incredibly fascinating story here and a really cool group of music and some really interesting creative stuff. And you're boiling it down to like, oh, what did he live up to the ideology that I would expect like a punk rock saint to live up to? And everyone makes that calculation, or at least I feel like over the years, a lot of people make that calculation. And I don't agree with that. I don't think that's the right way to think about, you know, early punk rock. And, you know, so that sort of thing kind of irks me. So I'm less worried that Joe doesn't deserve it, whatever it is. I'm more concerned that it sets this kind of weird precedence where we got to judge all of the original punk rock guys based on that. And I don't think we should.
Adam, I think those are words of wisdom, and I think we should close the podcast out on that. It'd be harder pressed to find anybody else to say anything better than that or anything more sage. Perhaps Adam White is one of these punk rockers that should be put on a pedestal for his words of wisdom.
At the very least, everyone should send me $20.
That's right. You heard it here, folks. And if you want to send us $20, you should first contact us at podcast@punknews.org. That's podcast@punknews.org. And tell us what's on your mind. Who's overly beatified? Who is overly spat upon? Speaking of guys that have been spat upon, Tom Trauma, thanks for being here tonight. Always a pleasure to have my Calvinist homie.
Exactly. Podcast. Been fun, guys. Thanks.
And Adam White, the Virgil of our time, the Homer of our time, the Aeschylus of our time, the Diogenes of our time. Thank you for putting on your toga, putting those laurels around your ears and sticking one hand in the air and speaking axioms and truths.
Not in a Nazi salute, though, with that one hand.
No. It's the palm upwards instead of faceward, it's upwards. And the other hand is holding up the part of the toga. And Adam just announces things. He's like, you know, he's like, when is a door not a door?
Sits on a mountain and waits for people to come to him.
Well, Adam, thanks for being on, as always.
Yeah.
And all right. This is Features Editor John. So we'll see you next week.